From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe. Subscribe to it today. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
A 50% increase in anti-Semitic incidents. We're talking assaults, vandalism, and harassment. Now, so far, we're on pace for a 20% increase.
We've all seen the headlines. Anti-Semitic acts are way up in the U.S. as Jews, along with other minority groups, are targeted in ways that seem linked to the public rhetoric our nation has endured in the past couple of years. At some point, we need to ask, what does the vow never again refer to? Very specifically, the genocidal murder of millions, or to one or more of the steps along the way that ultimately made that tragedy possible, especially here in America. I, for one, say let's not wait. And the resources needed to remember that history are available at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. On this week's show, I'll talk with Dr. Daniel Green, guest curator at an exhibit highlighting the Americans at the museum.
In the past 7 years, the number of Americans who don't belong to an organized religion has grown by nearly 20 million.
There's been no shortage in recent years of speculation that the extraordinary involvement of the religious right in the politics of our country has repelled many Americans, especially young people, from organized religion. But now, there's a comprehensive scholarly report that goes beyond speculation, and we'll dig into the data with author Paul Jupe. But first,
waterboarding is torture and is not permitted under Army Field Manual guidelines. Torture is illegal under international law. The Supreme Court noted in 2004 that the United States has a historical record of regarding waterboarding as a war crime and has prosecuted individuals for such practice in the past.
When our nation turned away from the Bush-era policies on torture, whether using euphemisms like enhanced interrogation techniques or admitting to the horrors that we know were perpetrated in our name, perhaps some of our leaders should have been held accountable. Perhaps the stain on our nation's soul should have been more conclusively confessed. Regardless, we now face the horrific prospect of re-legitimizing the idea of American torture as the Senate weighs confirming a new CIA director. For a sober look at why this matters so much, I'm happy to be able to call on the Reverend Ron Stief, Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. Ron, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be back on. Well, thank you.
Are you surprised that this subject is in front of us again? And what's this woman's connection to this horrific practice?
It is surprising because Gina Haspel, although a lot of her career is classified, she is career CIA, there are public reports that were unearthed with the Senate Intelligence Committee when they were looking at the history of the CIA torture program that was instituted after 9/11. There are public reports in there that show that she supervised a secret CIA black site in Thailand. It's reported there that at least one detainee, Al-Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded multiple times. This was a black site which is known to have used, you talk about torture, well, what is it? Forced nudity, walling, throwing people against the wall, confinement boxes, putting them in these small boxes, and like I said, waterboarding. This is known about what happened at a secret CIA black site that she supervised. The CIA records talk about the lower-level interrogators choking up, wanting to transfer, wanting to get out of there, questioning the legality of the techniques. All this is known. Plus, it's illegal for the CIA to torture since the U.S. Senate and President Obama in 2015 signed legislation to that effect. All this, and then President Trump knowingly appoints her and puts her into this confirmation process with the Senate to head our one of our most important agencies we have in this country, the Central Intelligence Agency. It doesn't make any sense.
You were at the confirmation hearing. What were your impressions?
Well, I took two things away from the confirmation hearing. The first is that a number of senators pressed Gina Haspel over and over again. You know, she talked about she has this personal code of ethics that was instilled in her from, you know, her parents. Mm-hmm. But when they pressed her to say, do you think torture is immoral? And they asked her a number of times to answer that. She would not answer that question. You know, it's not enough for somebody to say, I will not reinstitute a torture program, or I understand that it's against the law for the CIA to engage in torture. It's not enough for somebody to do that. We need moral leadership. We need somebody who knows that torture is immoral there at the CIA, because you're going to need to call on your moral compass if you're heading an agency like the CIA, and you need to know that it is immoral to torture another human being, whether you're religious or not. That's pretty broadly understood in this country.
Ron, I've heard her defenders claim that she really didn't do anything wrong, and if she did, she was just following orders. Does that defense hold up, especially in a historical context?
Interesting that you should mention that, because, you know, the National Religious Campaign Against Torture is a broad national coalition. We have over 300 faith organizations, many of them national groups, and one is TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. They got a letter of 200 rabbis that was delivered to every senator asking the senators to vote against Gina Haspel. And, you know, if you think about, if there's any community that has the right to talk about what happens when people go out and say, well, I was just following orders, certainly it's the Jewish community, right, in their history with Hitler. So they came right out and said, you know, we believe that every human being is created in God's image. This applies to everybody, whether you're a friend or an enemy. They talked about the shame and humiliation caused by torture, how it degrades the divine spark inherent in each of us. So how can you, as one human being to another, say, well, I was just following orders when I tortured you? It's not part of God's plan. And like I said, from the Jewish community and many others, all kinds of wrongdoing is done under the name of following orders. We need people who don't follow orders when an illegal order like torture this person is being given, not people who follow orders.
Ron, you work with diverse religious leaders, lots of them, thankfully, who have moral clarity on the issue of torture. So when you see political religious right apologists for this administration just dismiss any concern about torture, what does that make you think?
Well, what it makes me think is that they're enabling, at least on torture. Now, thankfully, not a lot of faith leaders have come out supporting torture, but a lot of them have come out supporting this president. This president has repeatedly stated a personal interest in restarting the program of torture that this country abandoned under Obama and under the previous Congress. So, you know, I really worry that moral leaders are enabling someone who really believes this. Why aren't they sitting down with the president instead of just supporting him out there regardless of what he says? Why aren't they sitting down with the president, as certainly we'd like to, but we haven't really been invited to do that in our coalition, but sit down with the president and talk to him about why you don't torture somebody, why it's immoral. But where are the faith leaders that are in his camp that do get to his office? Mm-hmm. Where are they when it comes time to talk to him about the morality of torture? What worries me now is that the United States Senate, which is supposed to serve as a check and balance against the president, who might have the wrong ideas, which is what I believe on torture, obviously, from what I've been saying, that the United States Senate now has a chance to confirm or deny a candidate for the CIA who is basically molded in Donald Trump's image around torture. Mm-hmm. And what concerns me even more about that is, you know, the Catholic community has raised this issue around this. If the Senate doesn't stand up to this nomination, you're potentially putting Catholic pastoral and humanitarian aid workers in danger or in a position of not being trusted because of this kind of reversal that the president has signaled on torture when appointing somebody like Gina Haspel. The National Council of Churches and other churches have said, you know, they're worried that if our president can symbolically get away with this and the Senate lets him get away with it, you'll have tyrants and dictators out there justifying their use of torture. And we know how bad it is in the world in some of these places like Syria with the human rights abuses. So it goes way beyond what any one individual may do or may not do. This is really symbolic of where our democracy is right now and what our Senate is going to do to stand up to a president who has this morbid fascination with torture.
What about the American public? Do you think the average American is aware enough of the risks of torture in our collective name?
Well, what I will say is that insofar as the American public pays attention to the news media, this nomination, and I credit a lot of the faith groups that were engaged in this effort with us on Gina Haspel and other groups, human rights groups, but a lot of the media story and a lot of what happened in the hearing room, it was all around the morality or the immorality of torture. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's in part because the American public understands that torture is a moral issue. Mm-hmm. You know, well, in the past, you'd have had people in there talking about and asking questions about, well, do you think torture works? What about this part of running the CIA? What about that part of the CIA? Sitting in that hearing room, I was amazed that the moral issues were the ones that came out, and then afterwards it was the moral issues and her inability to say that torture is immoral that really kind of was the headline coming out of the Senate hearing. And I believe the American people, I mean, the media doesn't always do everything right, but I don't believe they'd be reporting it that way if they didn't think that the American people had the sophistication to understand that, yeah, there's something wrong morally with a person who would support torture.
So if that is the attitude and that's the concern of the United States citizens, what does legitimizing this kind of abuse, no matter what the fears used to justify it, what does that do to the soul of our nation?
Well, it's not good. And we worked with folks at state levels to put petitions together and petition their senators on this issue. And I think in Florida alone, both Senator Nelson and Senator Rubio received a petition with almost 20,000 names of people in Florida who urged them to vote no on Haspel. And so I think the people of Florida and, you know, other states where these petition campaigns were being run, where we got great numbers from folks, they are saying we want some accountability. We don't believe that our nation should fall into the depth of darkness by going back on this dangerous path of being supportive of torture. Now, I want to be clear about what Haspel said in the hearing. She said that she would not restart the CIA program of torture under any circumstances. So, you know, you have to give her that. But really, I think what people were saying in asking for a no vote is that we don't believe that anybody with this kind of history deserves a place in our government based on what we think democracy in this country stands for. And they haven't given up on our democracy. They haven't given up on what this country stands for. Yeah. They believe we can be a country that has a CIA that does not torture people in there. And they and we are not going away. And it's interesting. I was at the nomination hearing when Mike Pompeo was asked that very question from the senators, you know, would you refuse mm-hmm. an order from Trump to go out and torture? And he said, yes. Gina Haspel did not do that. What she said is, I don't think the president would ask me to do that. Well, how do you know what the president's going to ask you, and do you have the fortitude to stand up and say no? If she did have the fortitude to stand up and say no, that was the time for her to say it, and she didn't. And there you get back again to the thing about just following orders. Mm-hmm. If your moral compass doesn't think that torture is immoral, if your president asks you to do something, even if it might not be legal and it isn't legal, you still might go out and do it if you think the circumstances permit. You can't have somebody really operating any of our government agencies if that's the way they're going to be operating.
Ron, talk to our listeners who want to do something about this. What can voters do to have an impact on the question of torture? And should they weigh in on the Haspel nomination? What else should they do?
Well, a lot of people, you know, over the coming days, you know, I'll give you a timeline. The Senate Intelligence Committee has had a hearing. They'll likely be taking a vote. And then, depending on what happens in that committee vote, she'll likely go before the full Senate. This all happens within the next week or so. Mm-hmm. It's an absolutely critical time for anyone to pick up the phone and call your senator. I don't care who your senator is, whether they said they support or oppose mm-hmm. this nomination. If they have a chance to vote at it, on this, which they probably will, they need to hear from you that you want them to vote no on somebody who's got this kind of a questionable moral character to run one of our nation's most critical, most important agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency, that does so much and has so many of our, you know, good people out in the field keeping an eye on making sure that the United States can continue to be safe and a legitimate source for human rights and other things in the world. So the stakes couldn't be higher, and the opportunity to act couldn't be greater. That this week is absolutely critical for people to make that phone call to their senators.
And Ron, tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the National Religious Campaign Against Torture and benefit from what you have on your website.
Well, they can get to NRCAT, NRCAT.org. We also have a very active Facebook presence with a lot of updates. We've had a number of press conferences on this issue this week, and can also get to our Twitter feed. Through those, you will be able to get background, see what other people are doing, some of the op-eds that have been published around the country this past week, and how you can plug in not just to the work here, but the ongoing work that we are doing to make sure that everybody in this country stands up and says, we can and we will make sure that this country does not return to a country that tortures people.
The Reverend Ron Stief is the Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, an interfaith organization of more than 325 religious organizations committed to ending U.S.-sponsored torture. Ron, thank you for giving some time to us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Walton. Appreciate it.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. How significant is the political focus of the religious right in the dissatisfaction young Americans increasingly report with organized religion on the whole? I'll ask researcher Paul Jupe later. A powerful and incredibly timely exhibit at the National Holocaust Museum titled The Americans. You'll meet curator Daniel Green. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. The politicization of the religious right has turned many Americans off to religion. The simple statement is popularly linked to the dramatic increase in the number of religiously unaffiliated among us, to falling rates of religiosity among young people, and to surveys describing public perception of Christianity as judgmental and hateful. But what seems obvious is one thing. Solid research is something else. And now we have exactly that, a new study titled Are the politics of the Christian right linked to state rates of the non-religious? The importance of salient controversy. And I am pleased to be joined by one of the authors, Paul A. Jupe. Paul, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, and thanks so much for having me today.
So what made you interested in doing this kind of research?
Well, I've been doing this sort of research for a very long time, and in some ways I got interested in politics and religion to kind of understand my family and where I was coming from. But it's also become a real academic study, too, because clearly the tenor of the nation, its politics, and its religion has changed quite a bit over the last several decades, quite radically. So we're really just trying to get a handle on exactly what's going on and what's driving it.
Tell me about your co-authors and the methodology that was used.
So I worked with actually a former student of mine who's now at the University of Buffalo. His name is Jake Neuheisel. And then another colleague at the University of Cincinnati, Kim Conger. The methodology was to look and to use some data from the what we call the religious census. So the United States Census doesn't collect religion data, hasn't done that since the 1930s. But we've used the religion data. So this is surveys of denominations and the number of members and congregations and that sort of thing. And we use the uncounted, the unaffiliated there. And then we also use some survey data across essentially the same time period. And the crucial one here that we're looking at is 2000 to 2010. And this is critical, of course, because the Christian right was, you know, very present in American politics. And the critical thing that we thought might tip people away from religion, the salient controversy bit, were the many ballot measures across the United States in the mid-2000s banning same-sex marriage or restricting gay rights in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Paul, tell us how significant is the relationship between politicized religion and reduced participation in religion?
Well, that's the critical piece that we were looking at here. And this actually has its roots back in the 1960s and controversy over civil rights and Vietnam War protests and this sort of thing. But there's a pretty much long-standing relationship now when religion gets involved and takes controversial stands. And, of course, in some ways, many people expect religion to do just this, to be a prophet, to speak to society and try to bring it back in line with a set of values that they espouse. But of course it has its downsides, and when religion gets politicized, when they take stands that are at odds with some portion of the community, then people start to evaluate religion not necessarily on what good works it does, on the kind of people, but really just on the political stands and whether they agree with the politics of that group. And that's what we found in the context of 2000 to 2010, is that when there was a salient controversy, when there was an attempt to ban same-sex marriage, of course they were all successful, then people started to move away from religion at a higher rate. Put differently, the rate of the religious nuns rose more quickly in those states.
When you look at different churches across the spectrum, can you see the difference between what happens in a politicized church and in one that may be prophetic but not political?
So we did that in another study, actually. So not in the one that that got me on this show, but one that's linked to it just before. And we found that when churches do more political things, they start to lose some of their marginal members. Hmm. And so this doesn't mean that it's just conservative political religion. It could be liberal political religion, but you know, everyone's going to have a beef if you take a political stand. And so you're going to lose some marginal members. And what I mean by that is the people that are well integrated within the church, that are attending on a regular basis, that are involved in the other activities of congregations, They're not much affected by this because they have long-standing ties with people. Mm-hmm. But the folks that aren't well integrated, that are kind of on the edge, they're much more likely to use their political differences to reevaluate their relationship with the congregation, and they tend to walk away. Hmm. But that, like I said, that takes place across the religious spectrum. So you find it in mainline Protestant churches, you find it in Catholic churches, you even find it, even though they like to deny that this happens, you even find it in evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm.
And even though disagreements over Donald Trump are driving some people out of evangelical churches. So this is happening across the religious spectrum.
Paul, I think it's important, though rarely discussed, that some of what you're describing also played out with the religious left during the civil rights era. You address this in your study, and I wish you'd talk about that, please.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And in many ways, that was the impetus for our study. I've spent a lot of time studying mainline Protestants, and of course, they and others were on the front lines of the civil rights movement, protests of the Vietnam War, and these sorts of things. And the research that was done in the 60s and early 1970s found that the most active congregations in these sorts of movements faced pretty severe losses in terms of donations and in terms of attendance. And that was really sort of the beginning of the big slide in mainline Protestant denominations. And it's continued to go down since then. One of the principal mechanisms, though, was the notion that if clergy took up politics, that they were ignoring what was going on in the congregation. So they weren't meeting people's basic needs. In research that I've done in the 2000s, we actually found that mainline Protestant clergy were very attentive to what was going on in their congregation. So they'd actually learned some lessons since the 1960s, and that's not too surprising. And in those congregations where people felt that their basic sort of spiritual needs were being met, they were able to access clergy counseling and this sort of thing, they didn't use the political difference to evaluate their clergy at all. And so that's kind of the model for if clergy are going to engage politics at all, they really need to make sure that the core mission of congregations are taken care of.
Was there anything about this particular research that surprised you?
Well, there were a couple of things that were surprising. Even though this is what we kind of set out to test, I was actually surprised that the rate of the nuns was not linked to the presence of the Christian right without the same-sex marriage ban. So Christian right could be very prominent in the state, but without that bit of salient controversy, it really didn't affect the climb in the nuns at all. So that was one little bit that was surprising. And then the other one is that the nuns have been increasing in more conservative states. So if you think about the kinds of states where same-sex marriage bans were likely to be enacted, so there were some that were very liberal, like Oregon, but there were some that were very conservative or borderline conservative, like Ohio and Alabama. On balance, they were conservative. And what that means is that the rate of the nuns started to catch up with the other states. And so there was a gap of about 3 or 4% at the beginning of this period, and that was cut in half by the end of this period. And so in some ways, the politics of the Christian right has been so extreme that it's almost been self-limiting, and it's undercutting the necessity of the core of its own success.
What do you consider the most important takeaways in this most recent study that people who care about religion and care about churches really need to know?
That's a really interesting question. I think it takes us to a place where we think about the state of American democracy today.
Mm.
And it's so easy because we're so polarized and there's so many strong feelings about, you know, people on the other side of the aisle that, you know, we need to think about these as Americans. We need to think about them as having needs. I like to think of the congregation as a model for society. And so if we think about what works for a congregation, of thinking about members as whole people with a diversity of needs and a diversity of perspectives, if we could apply that to the rest of the nation, then I think we'd be in pretty good shape.
Mm.
We need to figure out a way to push for a politics, for a system of communal care, where we try to embrace more people, where we're trying to be more inclusive. And I think that's sort of the key here. And if we don't, if we pursue, you know, really polarized politics, we're driving people out, and we're not going to be able to reach those people.
Dr. Paul A. Jupe is a political scientist at Denison University, specializing in religion and politics, social networks, and political behavior, and affiliated scholar with Public Religion Research Institute. Paul spent 5 years as co-editor of Politics and Religion. The new study is titled, Are the Politics of the Christian Right Linked to State Rates of the Non-Religious? The Importance of Salient Controversy, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Paul, it's great to meet you. Your observations are so important for us to know. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
The United States Holocaust Museum opened in 1993 as a living memorial that inspires citizens and leaders worldwide to confront hatred, prevent genocide, and promote human dignity. Exhibits regularly raise provocative and painful questions, and the new installation, What Did Americans Know, is no exception. Joining me right now is guest curator Daniel Green. Dr. Green, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
How did you go about putting this exhibit together? I can't even imagine, but I'm interested in hearing your answer.
A large team at the Holocaust Memorial Museum has been working on Americans and the Holocaust for nearly 5 years now. And we wanted to take a very comprehensive approach to our research and to looking at American society. So we looked at all aspects of American society, obviously the U.S. government, but also asking questions like, how did popular culture respond to the threat of Nazism? How did the American media respond? How did faith leaders respond? And how did average Americans respond? So it was, I think it's safe to say this is the most comprehensive research project into this topic that's been attempted, certainly by a museum and maybe ever. And it was not just me. It was a large team of researchers at the Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Describe, if you will, what visitors to this exhibit will experience.
Well, visitors to the exhibit will see a lot about what America looked like in the 1930s and 40s. It's 80 years ago, so there's some living witnesses, but for many of our visitors, high school and college students, it may seem like ancient history. And what we wanted to show was how the context of the United States at the time shaped responses to Nazism. And what I mean by that context is Americans' isolationism from world affairs in the aftermath of World War I. The xenophobia, racism, and anti-Semitism that characterized American society during the 30s and 40s. And then especially the Great Depression, which weighed so heavily over the United States in the 1930s. And then, of course, the war in the 1940s. One of the things we really wanted visitors to understand is that Americans had access to a lot of information about Nazi Germany, including the persecution and murder of Europe's Jews, as it was going on. And we want to raise tough questions at the museum. And so the tough question is, if we had this information, why didn't rescue of Jews become a priority?
Well, as we look at the surge in anti-Semitism across parts of the globe today, without being hyperbolic, I want to ask you, at what stage did some Americans step up to challenge the course of events during those pre-Holocaust years? What did it take for people to wake up?
Well, some stood up right away. When Hitler takes power in January of 1933, the American media and the American people are interested. We see this democracy crumble in Germany, and we see a new world leader. And so you see Hitler on the cover of very popular magazines. And actually what you see is faith leaders, Jewish and others, take to the streets in the spring of 1933. There are rallies across many northern cities, anti-Nazi rallies. There are protests. There are movements to boycott German-made goods. One of the questions that really hounded me throughout this process is, when does a protest become a mass movement? We see a lot of protest of Nazism, but we don't see, I think, a sustained anti-Nazi movement in the United States in the 1930s. And I think that's in large part because of the crisis of the Great Depression at home. If you don't have a job and you can't feed your children, that's what's on your mind every day. But you do see at times, especially faith leaders, stand up against Nazism. Later on in this history, here I'm talking about the late 1930s, early 1940s, when Americans really realize there's a refugee crisis, you do see some Americans take risks, financial risks, other types of risks, to aid refugees. But they're the ones going against the grain. They're not the mainstream. And I also wondered, why do these people do this? Why make sacrifices to aid strangers, to aid refugees? And with faith leaders, whether it's Quakers or Mennonites or Unitarians and others, they'll point to a religious basis for their actions. But some others just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, you do this because it's the right thing to do, but it's not the mainstream.
Well, is it correct to say that most people here never became engaged in resistance?
I think it is correct. I think that you're right. Most people did not become engaged in resistance, but historians have sometimes used the explanation of, well, we just didn't know what was going on. And to me, that's an excuse, and it's an excuse that's not sustainable or provable. Many Americans did know what's going on. One way you see this, a fascinating way you see this, is through public opinion polls in the United States. Gallup is asking Americans in 1938, do you disapprove of the Nazis' treatment of Jews? And the vast majority, 94% of Americans, say yes, they disapprove. Later on, Gallup is asking Americans whether they believe that mass murder is occurring in 1943-44. And you see an uptick over time. Americans do believe it. So it's not that we don't have information, and it's not that we don't know what's going on. So the haunting question is, why doesn't disapproval lead to action on behalf of the victims?
Well, this is the second time that question has come up. So let's go ahead. Tell us what you think the answer to that is.
I think sometimes individuals feel powerless. So they may realize that something terrible is going on, but not know how to respond. They might feel that an individual can't make a difference. And it's the mission of our museum, actually, to show that individuals can make a difference. So actually, when visitors walk into, even outside the gallery for the exhibition Americans and the Holocaust, they're confronted with two questions. One is, what did Americans know? And that's what I've been talking about here. And the other is, what more could have been done? And that's a harder question to get at, but we get at it by showing examples of people who took risks to rescue refugees or tried to pressure the U.S. government to do more to aid refugees. So it's through those counterexamples of people who went against the grain that we try to encourage people not to feel powerless in the face of atrocities.
Daniel, I have no intention to be hyperbolic, as I said before, but there has to be a way that we can talk about what that era and the present day have in common. Or by definition, we can't learn from history if we can't contextualize it. So what are some of the parallels?
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. And the exhibition is a history exhibition about the 1930s and 40s. The museum believes in the value of studying history. But of course, there are resonances today. And, you know, when the museum opened 25 years ago, Elie Wiesel, who was our founding chairperson, stood on the plaza outside the museum and he said, "This museum is not an answer, it's a question mark." And I think about that a lot, and the team thought about that a lot. What are the difficult questions that we wanted to raise? And so here, some of the difficult questions are, how do Americans debate their responsibilities to refugees? When we learn that a population is targeted for murder in a genocide, how do we debate our responsibilities to respond? Even with World War II, I think many visitors don't realize the depths of American isolationism. in the 30s and 40s. When Europe goes to war in 39, right away, 90% of Americans say we want to stay out. So also, how do we debate our responsibility to enter a war that many Americans consider a foreign war? We want to raise these tough questions. We don't want to put a neat bow on this history and wrap everything in a package that's always palatable and saying this is the answer. We actually feel like people should struggle with this history, but many of these questions are being asked today, and they can be asked in a more educated way and a more informed way by understanding that it's not the first time that Americans have faced these questions.
Yeah. I'm really curious about whether or not, as this exhibition gets attention, if you're going to hear any people saying, well, this really shouldn't be done because it makes us look bad, and we're trying to make America great again, and so why are you doing this to us?
We never thought about it that way at the museum. It's not a finger wagging exhibition. Much more an exhibition about showing that Americans had much more information than many people assume about the threat of Nazism, showing the great sacrifices that millions of Americans made in World War II to defeat Nazism. That is central to the exhibition. Of over 400,000 Americans lost their lives fighting in World War II, and 16 million Americans served. But then millions more at home made sacrifices to defeat Nazism. So our country is mobilized to fight this fascist threat. Some people may say it mobilizes too slowly, but ultimately you do see it mobilized. And it's one of the, as President Roosevelt said, he called it the most tremendous undertaking in our American history. We want to honor that undertaking, but also ask why within that war humanitarian aims or rescue of the victims never became a priority.
Yeah. Thankfully, there's been a lot of interfaith cooperation in the past couple of years, particularly in terms of Muslim and Jewish communities in different cities standing together against bigotry and hate. Talk for a moment about how important these kinds of initiatives are, if you would.
They're critically important. The Holocaust Museum is not a museum solely for Jewish visitors. In fact, more than 90% of the people who come through the museum are not Jewish. It's important for all people to understand the potential worst outcomes of prejudice, hate, and bigotry. And the Holocaust is a terrible example of those potential outcomes. You know, there's a great story in the exhibition that I think of often, too, of a small community in Southbury, Connecticut, where the German-American Bund, Nazi sympathizers, wanted to set up a Hitler Youth-style summer camp. And it's the Congregationalist minister in that community at the South Britain Congregationalist Church in Connecticut who rallies faith leaders in Connecticut to say, we can't have a Nazi camp in our backyard. And he gives this very stirring sermon. His name is Reverend Lindsay, Edgar Lindsay. And he gives a very stirring sermon, Thanksgiving weekend of 1937, where he says, we need to keep the Nazis out because Nazis are unchristian and un-American. He's really looking at the fascist threat to American Christianity and to American values writ large. And he is, you do see interfaith efforts to mobilize against Nazism. Again, they're not the mainstream. They don't lead to a sustained anti-Nazi mass movement. But they're critically important, and Lindsay's effort is successful at the Nazi sympathizers abandon their hope to set up a summer camp in Southbury. So these local stories of what's possible with interfaith cooperation, we hope will inspire some of our visitors as well.
Daniel, what else should listeners know about this exhibit at the museum, including how long it will be on display?
The exhibition just opened, and it will be open for 3.5 years, so through the autumn of 2021. So visitors have a lot of time to get there. But for visitors who don't have time to get to Washington, D.C., there is a web version of the exhibition on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum site, so people can just search for Americans on the Holocaust under the museum's webpage.
I'm just at the end of our time, but I've got to ask you the question, what did working on this project do to you?
I've studied American response to the Holocaust now for more than 20 years. I think the thing that surprised me most was the depth of information that Americans had. But I think the thing that I try to honor most is the fact that these are the last moments to talk to living witnesses of this history, not only Holocaust survivors, but American veterans who encountered concentration camps. And that is such a privilege that I think that we have at this moment that I know that my children will have to a lesser extent and my grandchildren won't have. And I feel that we're at a critical moment in trying to preserve memory through living witnesses as well. And I thought about that a lot along the way.
Yeah. Historian Daniel Green is guest curator of Americans and the Holocaust, an exhibition at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Dr. Green is adjunct professor, Department of History, Northwestern University. The United States Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is open to the public daily, and admission is free. Dr. Green, I'm really glad we got to talk because it's so good to hear what you have done and this exhibit that can make a real contribution, not just in understanding the past, but also in looking at where we are in the present. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your interest in the museum's work.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.